Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, Episode 13, Plasma Geek Out. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/theater. Greetings, it's Scott Wilkinson with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. My guest geek of the week is Josh Kiroff, Chief Technologist for Display Engineering Incorporated, and formerly the Director of Display Engineering at Pioneer. Hey, Josh, welcome to the show.
Howdy. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you, indeed. Okay, I got to start by asking this. What the hell happened to Kuro?
It lost its way and fell off a bridge. I don't know.
Now, you obviously were involved intimately in the whole Kuro project. I remember when it was first introduced at CES and everybody went nuts over it. You know, I remember that that display space that you guys had at your CES booth, and it was pitch black in there. And all of a sudden, this image starts floating out in the middle of space. And the TV had been on, and the black level was so deep that you couldn't tell the TV was on.
Yeah, that was actually that whole presentation was kind of funny. That was a thought exercise we had done a couple years before. But you know, wouldn't it be cool if you could make one so dark you couldn't even see it as being on? And that was, the engineers kind of took that as a challenge, and that was one of the design considerations. It turns out with plasma, the static state of it being no image produces light from the reset pulses and things. So minimizing that, throttling it back, was actually kind of hard. it's a different state change between nothing and more than nothing. So you had to kind of put in a separate managing system for black. But yeah, it was pretty impressive.
Very impressive. I mean,
Kuro's behind me.
You got one behind you. There you go. Good. I'm glad you got one before you got out. There it is. Yay.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I got one too, and so did all the reviewers I know, because it was clearly identified as, you know, the best flat panel picture you could get, period.
Yep.
And it still is.
Yep. The 9G monitor, I think, is probably the best one I ever did. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous image.
Yeah. Well, that's the one behind me, actually. You can see it in off to the side here, is the 9G monitor, the signature monitor, because, man, oh, man, that thing looks good. And so what happened? I've asked Andy Parsons this question as well, and he just sort of said, well, it wasn't economically feasible to make the Kuro anymore. Couldn't make money on it. Is the answer really as simple as that?
Yeah, but it's having gotten to that point that you couldn't make money of it. That was sort of the comedy of errors.
How do you mean?
It's. I don't think it's a valid premise to think that you can sell a Ferrari at a Ford dealership in Ford volumes. So yeah, if you're going to go for a Ferrari or a Porsche,
right?
Then you don't want to sell them at Volkswagen dealerships. and you don't want to put a lot of dealerships in every town, or your product price will have to come down. So those are wonderful TVs, and I think if they had kept the sales channel that originally Pioneer had, it probably would have maintained its value, but the volume wasn't what they tried to do. So it was just a comedy of errors.
What was the sales channel?
Mass market.
The
idea of an Elite or a Kuro, something that has a step-up value, can't be merchandised in an open box kind of way. Because then all you're doing is you're competing on price. And that environment is not conducive to seeing quality.
Yeah.
So people look at a high price and a price that was, you know, a third less and go, I can't tell the difference. So then the sales channel there had to upsell it. So price became down, and then the factory was not able to produce them, you know, at that at those price points.
Yeah. I should mention, for those of you watching the video stream here, that unfortunately, Josh is suffering a power outage at his house, and so he's running on batteries, and that may be why the frame rate, video frame rate, isn't as good as it might be.
And a Sprint card.
I'm sorry?
And a Sprint wireless card.
Oh, so yes, a Sprint wireless card on
this,
your
this is the internet. Yes, right. We do what we do. We go through it.
You know, exactly. And that's Leo's philosophy, certainly, is let's use the technology that's available to people to produce these podcasts and everything else. So occasionally we'll run into a few problems, but we soldier on, and here we are. And again, yeah. I'm really glad to have you on the show because you're one of the most technically oriented plasma guys I know. So let me ask you the next question, and this might take us a while, but I hope it does. You've heard undoubtedly Panasonic's woes, right?
Their
increasing black level. At the AVS forum, some members of the forum noted that their Panasonic plasmas from 2008, 2009, the black level was increasing, in some cases dramatically and overnight, which seemed kind of odd to me. And Panasonic even admitted it and said, yeah, we're doing that. We need to increase the drive voltage over time because we need to compensate for the aging of the phosphors. So I just wanted to get your hit on that, what you've heard about it. I mean, I know you don't work for Panasonic, you don't represent Panasonic, and nothing you say is officially from Panasonic. Let's make that very clear, shall we?
Absolutely.
You don't even work for Pioneer anymore, so.
No.
But as a plasma guru, I'd like to know, you know, what you think of this whole situation.
Well, I think what they were doing, from what I've read about it and a couple of my friends I've talked to who have more intricate knowledge with it, yeah, there were some circuits inside, time circuits, that they're compensating much the same way as a feedback system within like a projector. We keep the lamp at a certain light output. So you say, let's lamp can produce, I don't know, 100 lumens, and you set it to be at 60. So that you always have a headroom you can turn up to keep the experience constant, which is just it's a regulated feedback system.
Sure.
And what Panasonic appears to have done was to use a clock to count something, time or pulses or moon phase or something, to make arbitrary adjustments. What we're saying is that how is this? Some people are having problems and some aren't. How are they pick the wrong indications of time? If the person had time, if they've used a bunch of the phosphors, has worn it down, so to speak, then the adjustments that were made by the internal registers of the Panasonic probably would have been more as expected. If someone hadn't used their plasma set a lot, had it calibrated so it wasn't overtaxing the phosphor, then the adjustments that took place over time or whatever counter they used were more noticeable.
And this would be more likely to be members of the AVS forum, of course,
right? Who have throttled it back, who are you know, sending it to appropriate levels of light, and therefore when it does decide to make its change, readjust itself as it was designed to do, it's more noticeable because it wasn't as worn as the engineers anticipated it would have been at that point.
Ah, of course, because they're anticipating people take it out of the box and use it in torch mode.
And I'm sure that they tested this very, very well, but they didn't necessarily test it as one group of users would use the display.
Right.
At Pioneer, we had a problem where we actually had a recall for some power supplies of our plasmas. Because they tested them very, very well. But what they didn't anticipate was the number of people turning it on and off multiple times.
And really? They think that people would just keep it on all the time?
Yep. And in Japan, they're very conscious of power. So people would turn off the set when they would go to the bathroom. They would turn on and off multiple times. And it was putting stress on the components of the power supply above what they had anticipated. So they had a big recall on power supplies.
That's incredible. Now, I have to say that I don't go that far. I don't turn off the TV when I'm going to the bathroom or anything like that, but I tend not to just leave it on all day because plasmas, after all, do have a finite lifespan, right?
Sure. Well, yeah, like any phosphor-based device or anything that makes light is going to, you know,
Something's being worn out. Yeah. Now, with a projector, you can always just replace the lamp, right, and keep going. But in the case of a plasma, you know, once it dims to half brightness, I mean, that's it.
Yeah, I think probably they will be destroyed from earthquakes or Nerf footballs, or you'll be so sick of how it looks, or it will be relinquished to, you know, your third cousin's brother. They're not going to wear out. I mean, we have units that were made the first and second generations, so that'd be like 10 years plus, that are still in operation and still looking beautiful.
You're talking about first generation of Pioneer plasma or plasmas in general? Because now we're at, what, 10 or 11?
Pioneer.
Hmm? The, I say like now the, we're the, at
the
like
10
or
11. The 10th gen. If Pioneer had still made it, it probably would. I think it would be the 10th gen they would be selling now.
The last gen of Pioneer was 9.
Right.
And you're saying that there are first generation Pioneer plasmas still out there and still looking fine.
Still looking fine.
Yeah.
But the new technology. People started to freak out about everything.
Right.
Had some very early, what they called ZANZO, or temporary image retention, which got everyone scared about burn-in.
Right.
And the reality is that, you know, you don't see too many burned-in plasmas. You got a lot of scare.
Don't.
Right. In the initial part of their life, they have a very a fast aging curve. So from time zero to time, call it 100 or whatever, you're going to have a deterioration of light output or given amount of energy input.
Mm-hmm.
That curve is going to go more rapidly in the beginning. After, I don't know, let's call it 1,000 hours or something.
Really that 1,000, long, 1,000 hours?
That curve has become very flat, and it still will wear, but it's not, you're nowhere near that acceleration curve at the beginning.
Right.
And what that means is that, you know, after 4,000 hours or something, it's going to take a lot longer to get any more decrease of light level.
Mm-hmm.
So I think by the time you've had a plasma for 2 years, in the course of how long you keep it, you won't sense it's getting any dimmer. I mean, realistically, you know, if you're critical, you run it in torch mode a lot. But for typical people, yeah, you're going to get your 7 to 10 years out of it. You're going to throw it away before it breaks.
Right. Right. I mean, these things are, I mean, the Panasonic, I know, is rates its plasmas at 60,000 hours to half brightness. And that is, I forget exactly, something like 20 years at 8 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah, it's that was the specsmanship side, too. I mean, all the numbers of, how much this and how much a mutual friend of ours who has his own little web blog has been trying to find out what the life of fluorescent bulbs are. Under the idea that, you know, if they're used in LCDs, that's real governing of how long an LCD will last.
Right.
And he's going crazy. He can't get good data on when bulbs wear out. But
if you go running them, just running out fluorescence just constantly?
Well, he's tried that. He's trying to get published, you know, reports. He's trying to get wear data. He's trying to, you know, get something to promote.
Right.
But it's a valid, you know, observation. I mean, we all look in office, in a typical office building, there's lots of fluorescence. And every 6 months or something, someone comes in and they'll replace a bulb. You know, it'll flicker. It'll be dim, right? Well, that's what's inside LCDs. They're going to go dim.
Well, yeah, that's true. And we're going to get to LCDs in a minute here. But first, I just wanted to reinforce, shall we say, reinforce the dispellation. Is that a word? I don't know. of some plasma myths. I still get I still get reader letters saying, oh, I've heard that, I shouldn't get plasma because the gas leaks out, or it needs to be recharged, or certainly the burn-in issue, which we've talked about now. And how do you address these, which you must get all the time too?
A smile, a smirk, a giggle, perhaps. I sometimes find that look that you can give someone that says, "Ah, Gilligan, excellent question. Yes." All right. It's just confusion. I mean, the one we forget about, we've got so involved in the technology of what made the picture, we forgot about the aspect ratio problems we were having before that.
Say that again, please.
The aspect ratio problems. We've had a TV that was 4:3 since the beginning of time.
Right.
Now it's 16:9. But when we first started to see some CRTs come out, aspect ratio. Then the next problem on everyone's list was, burn-in or wear factor or gas recharging. I think we all just like to have problems with our appliances.
Humans by nature prefer to have problems with their appliances.
Yes.
Kyrov's law number one. Okay.
Yeah. Exactly. we need something to bitch about. I recently purchased a 60-inch plasma. And for the environment I was in, it was to watch movies, it's lower lighting, and there's no real reflection issues.
Right.
So I wanted a plasma. It has a better picture in darker rooms, in darker environments.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought the cheapest one I could find.
Really?
I bought the absolute cheapest one I could find. And it was wonderful. Because it's not a critical viewing distance. It's not a critical environment. It's a social room.
It's just something to have on to watch certain things. And it's not like you're using your golden eyes, which I know you have.
Right. I hope I still have them. one of the things I look at is that, even the cheapest thing I could find looks pretty good.
You know, isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I
kind of, when people are talking about these burn-ins or image, what should I use? It's like, the worst thing you can find out there is probably pretty good. And if you're just going to watch TV in a room and all that, buy technology, but buy the biggest thing you can afford. Don't pay much attention to the technologies, because if you like it, you've saved a lot of time and energy and money. If you don't like it, you'll know exactly why. And you can sell it to someone else or buy what you really need.
Mm-hmm.
But it's silly to think that with all this newness between aspect ratio, between the methods of making the pictures, the type of cables to connect, the sources, nobody can make the right decision the first time out.
Right. Well, isn't there some justification for thinking about LCD versus plasma, for example? I mean, this is the other perennial question I get all the time.
Yeah, but for most people who are looking for a TV, I think their expectations are so confused. Probably they're upgrading from a CRT.
Very likely, yeah.
Yeah, so the whole idea of this new shape, this new thinness, they don't know where to put their VCR because you can't put it on top of the thing.
True enough.
And they get lost in all the confusion.
Yeah.
How many times have you seen definition? Because it says it's high definition. And they've hooked it up with a composite video cable from the set-top box.
Mm-hmm. And they think, I'm getting high def. Wow, why does that look so crappy?
Or does it look better than their old CRT did? In which case, they're going, cool.
Yeah, right. They may, in fact, say that. I mean, composite notwithstanding.
And then you hook up component or an HDMI, and suddenly they're going, oh, wow, and they're blown away.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a slippery slope of improvement, and where everyone's coming from was so horrible, and they accepted it. Anything you do now is probably going to be good.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, what was I guess it might be unfair to ask you this, and if it is, just let me know, but what plasma did you end up with, 60 inches?
Got an LG.
LG?
Because it was very inexpensive, and I think it was probably one model cycle old. And it was very inexpensive.
but it
arrived.
We keep getting back to that, don't we?
It was cheap.
Yeah,
it was really cheap.
Well, I have to say, I've been reviewing LGs now for and Panasonics and all the rest of them for quite a few years, and mostly, I haven't done a lot of LG plasmas lately, but I have done quite a few LCDs. Most of them have not performed very well until this current generation. Actually, I'm not reviewing it. Tom Norton is. LE8500 LED backlit LCD. And it looks fabulous. And it's way less expensive than the corresponding Samsung.
Yeah.
So, you know, they are, in fact, improving their situation, it seems. And I would actually look forward to checking out one of the new plasmas.
Yeah, it's been about, let's call it 3 years, maybe 4 years, that mm-hmm. everyone's quality suddenly just has taken steps up. And people weren't, chip manufacturers are making better all-in-one integrated solutions, you know, for decoding or scaling or
video processing.
OSD, video processing, yeah. So the cost of making better is getting less. Mm. And then, you know, as manufacturers go through their surplus of inventory because they bought, you know, 400 million of some chip that did never look very good.
Right.
As they're buying new things, they're getting current technologies.
And looking better.
This is a good time to be buying inexpensive, high-quality picture-making devices.
I mean, Vizio certainly is doing very well.
Yeah. I've done some work with Vizio, and I'm very impressed with them. I'm critical of them, but then I have to keep reminding myself that that's not the market. That's not the customer.
You know, right, not the golden eyes, the AVS forum guys. We're talking mass right. market here, really.
And it does a good job of turning on, looking good. Now they're off playing with something else. Yeah, I wouldn't want one in my dark movie watching, you know, critical viewing, my home theater. I would be bugged by it there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just such a small part of what most people do with it. Even enthusiasts tend to share the, you know, their display rooms with kids and things and, you know,
someone
who's trying to knit. Yeah.
So one other question, getting back to Kuro for just a second. How did Kuro manage to avoid increasing its black levels? I mean, first of all, let me preface that with this question. In your experience, to your knowledge, do all plasmas have to do some sort of drive voltage increase over time to compensate for the wear of the plasmas of the phosphors, or is that something that Panasonic's doing but other people aren't? I've tried to ask this question of Samsung and LG, and LG has not gotten back to me with an answer yet, so I don't know what their official response is. Samsung's somewhat semi-official, semi-unofficial response is, oh, I don't think we do that.
My guess is that anyone who is using plasma as a display medium and has any kind of evolved and developed manufacturing capability, if they've been in it for a few years, they're utilizing some system of making small adjustments over time as a way to keep the pictures looking more consistent.
Right.
It's just too easy to not do that.
Right.
The phosphors vary at different. So your
colors age at different rates, right? I mean, the different colors age even at different rates.
Yep. So if you didn't want things to become, more orangish over time, be kind of orangish, then you would probably put some mechanism in to kind of make some assumptions about where colors should be pushed or the balancings. And I know at Pioneer we did it. We never promoted it because it wasn't really a feature. It was just part of how we made our plasmas look good for a long period of time, give people good, consistent pictures.
So how did the Pioneer manage to avoid increasing black levels over time?
Well, how did it avoid increasing black levels? The way we were doing it at a course overview, we paid attention to how the phosphors were being used, and we counted their use cycle, if you will. So we were keeping track of the red, green, and blue, and how much they were being told to make light over time. Mm. And then at certain points, we made some very gradual changes. turning up, basically. But we took a long time to make sure that what we were doing was invisible. And we actually had these functions that were sort of hidden in some of the deep service menus where they had different rates. You could adjust the rate of compensation. We just kept improving it, but again, taking very small, subtle steps.
Right.
I think my guess is that the next generation of Panasonic will take a similar approach, because I think they probably discovered this problem before ABS Form, and they had already begun to correct it.
Yes.
Or design the next correction in.
Right.
My guess is they just took too coarse of a adjustment. Someone didn't think about how they could be used, so they applied a heavy hand to adjustment.
And the big problem, of course, for us, for reviewers, is that we can't test that because it takes hundreds of hours.
Yep. And every phosphor-based display is going to have slightly different baselines on it. I mean, as you know, from measuring, no two units are precisely the same to the nth decimal point.
Yeah, exactly right.
So you'd have to take two displays and type them. Okay, we see what they are, and then keep one turned off, and then have the other one blow out for, 1,000 hours, and then see those differentials. The only thing I know that's close to that is the Plasma Display Coalition with ISF did some burn-in analysis, and we aged plasmas for a long time. Over at Imaging Sciences, Joel Silver was sort of took a big hand in putting some tests together, and we plotted a lot of information about how plasmas age and whether burn-ins are there, and it was part of a very pro-plasma campaign.
Sure,
and
the Plasma Coalition, after all.
Yeah, and there was some stuff there about how contrast ratios actually improved over time, because the illumination, the static illumination, because the phosphors were getting a little more worn, the blacks got darker, because again, they're not as efficient light producers.
Right.
So why it's the other way with Panasonic, I don't know. I don't know the mechanics, but it's a compensation circuit that is. Just about, I think, a little too coarse in its adjustment.
Overactive, perhaps?
A little overactive, and probably maybe not the most optimum thing to be measuring, whether it's time or use.
Understood.
Yeah.
Understood.
It also seems like there should be a way to have that reset, because
wondering about that, too.
If you had the components within a display, they have to be serviced, and if you took out a board that was new and you put it in, if you have an old board and you put a new board in, you got to make that new board emulate whatever the old board was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have components that had different amounts of time that may not have known how long that plasma had been operating and what level to be at. So there has to be some kind of setting there where you could repair a customer's television without making it look dramatically different. I'm sure, like all things, the due diligence of the ABS Forum crew will exercise this to the nth degree.
No doubt. Well, it's a fascinating story, and I sure appreciate your insight on it. Before we continue, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, Audible.com. Audible.com is a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 60,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For listeners of Home Theater Geeks, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook you may consider downloading is Star Trek Movie Memories, written and read by William Shatner, who, I have to say, today is his 79th birthday. So, happy birthday, Denny Crane. Or Captain Kirk, or T.J. Hooker, or Priceline guy. He is 79 years old today. Yep. Unbelievable.
Damn. That means I'm not 21 anymore.
Can you imagine? It's really sad.
Yeah.
But he's great. I love William Shatner. And if you don't mind listening to him read his own book in the way that he often does... I'm sure it's a, I read the book actually, and it's really fascinating. So, to download this audiobook or another one of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/theater. That's audiblepodcast.com/theater. Okay, back to plasmas.
Back to plasmas.
Back to plasma.
So I got one for you, Scott. What was the first plasma you ever saw?
Ooh, good question. The first plasma I ever saw was probably... might have been a Fujitsu. It was... I'm pretty sure it was 480p. I can't remember the exact circumstances now, but, you know, it was probably 480p. It was probably $10,000 or $15,000. It weighed a ton. And look how far we've come since then. When was the first plasma introduced? I mean, it must have been 10 years ago.
Oh, no.
I mean, to the consumer marketplace. I don't mean professionally, but
more than 10 years ago, it was going to be probably 12, 13 years ago is when they first started to come in. There was these, you know, demos and way overpriced 42s.
42s, yeah.
You know, 6-bit adaptive quantizing.
Yeah.
First one I saw was the Toshiba T31 laptop that had that orange plasma screen.
With a plasma screen?
Yep. It was the Toshiba T31, and it was a laptop, but it had no battery. You had to plug it in. I believe it had
imagine running a plasma on a battery.
Right. It was a 386 processor. It was a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
But back then I went, wow, this is kind of cool technology. You know, it's making light. It's not that filtering stuff. It's actually producing light. I like this.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yep. I remember. And look how far, as I said, look how far we've come. We now have 1080p, which plasma, as I recall, sort of lagged behind LCD in terms of resolution.
Yeah. Very much so. It turns out, though, I think, were you there for the test that Jeffrey Morrison did with the displays?
I've been there for several when Jeff Morrison was with the Home Theater magazine. We did several face-offs or shootouts or whatever you want to call them, and he
threw one of the low res the 720p pioneers in, and
I don't remember that liked, one.
He was doing a test of I think 42-inch class, and all of them were supposed to be 1080p, but he put a ringer in. He threw a pioneer in a 720p. Everyone chose that one as being the best.
No kidding.
Because again, it's not resolution. Your eye sees contrast ratio.
Resolution, right. Or rather to say your eye is much more sensitive to contrast ratio.
Right. Yes. Yes. And with contrast, good contrast, that makes a more satisfying picture than more pixels.
Interesting. Now, was that a Kuro that he threw in there?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I don't know that we were calling it Kuro at that point, but it was I think it was probably a 7th gen, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm. Like the Pro HD FD1, I've forgotten what that was called, the one just before the Kuros. That was 1080p. That was one of the first 1080p's.
Yep. That one was made for Blu-ray. That was produced so that the Blu-ray could actually look good, because there wasn't any displays out there that could really show off how good of a signal Blu-ray could make.
Hmm.
So... Pioneer's Blu-ray and Pioneer's and the FHD1 were very much thought about as a tandem pair.
Ah, interesting. And
pretty gorgeous pictures on that thing.
Oh, yeah, beautiful. I reviewed that set several years ago, and yeah. I loved everything about it except the black level.
It had an elevated black. They were concerned about light output, because that's what everyone was yelling about at that moment. How bright can you make it? How bright can you make it? And it's like, okay, they're bright enough now. Can we start to make it now not as bright, please?
And rightly so, because as you said, the contrast ratio is is very important. And if the blacks are high, you're just not going to get that much of a contrast ratio.
Absolutely. Oh. Yep. No, I don't know of any LCD or plasma out there now that I would ever say is not bright enough.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Everybody's got
plenty of brightness. In fact, I mean, coming out of the box, you can measure things, 50, 60, 70 foot Lamberts, mostly what you want in a dark room is like under 30.
Yeah, I usually shoot for 35 to 40.
Really, that high?
Well, the idea is that when I'm doing calibrations for people, that's a good number because people tend to be initially, they want punch. Mm. Now, not for a real enthusiast, someone who's really paying attention, then it might be closer to 30. Yeah, probably top out about 30.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But for the general consumer, you're saying they like it a little hotter.
A little hotter. And it can do it, and it's not going to really hurt anything. And I've sort of taken the approach now in calibrations that there's accuracy, and then there's enjoyable.
Enjoyability, and, yes.
Yeah. And there's a balance there between, what someone expects from that new device they have and what maybe is their best thing for them to be doing. So, yeah, if it's multi-purpose sort of environment, I'll go between 35 and 40.
Mm. Certainly, if there's some light in the room, I would agree with you there. My room, which those who are watching on video can see behind me, is pretty lit up right now so that we have video, but it really is a black hole. And that's not the typical consumer viewing environment. I realize that.
Yeah. It's interesting doing calibrations because I'm used to having all the adjustment capability of a plasma, of a very good display that, although it has, they'll have characteristics of a floating S gamma. They'll play with the management of the image.
Mm-hmm.
It's really strange to try to now get good adjustments on LCDs because you got this backlight issue.
Yes.
That may or may not be tracking. You've got zoning, which can kind of be great for making some pictures look good and not others.
You're talking about LED backlighting with local dimming.
Yep. And even when they were using, they were trying some localized dimming concepts with fluorescence, which section of the screen is going to be lit up or not.
Really? I don't remember that.
Yeah, it was they were being able to control, I think it was four different horizontal stripes, top, middle, lower section.
Lower, middle, yeah. Bottom. Yeah, right. Yeah. I can't imagine that being very effective, though.
No. Not at all.
Oh, yeah, right, okay.
was that a condition? Oh, I get it.
Right. Why is it? Do you know this? I've always been wondering this question. Why is it that plasmas have this very reflective screen, which is a problem in a lit room? Because you can see reflections of objects in the room if there's a lot of light in the room. Whereas most LCDs, not all but many, have this more matte screen, which helps with this reflective problem. Why that basic difference?
Matte screen, that film coating on LCDs, is part of the LCD process of manufacturing them, makes that very easy to do. That's just sort of the nature of that beast.
I gotcha.
Whereas in a plasma, you have a glass front.
Yeah.
So already having this glass sandwich, and they're using glass as a filter, if the filters aren't bonded to one of the pieces of glass, mm-hmm. Getting it to become non-reflective requires yet another coating on it, which would diffuse it out, and it can make it a little less sharp.
Right,
and it can cut some light.
Mm-hmm. So
in the LCD, getting high amounts of light is relatively easy and doesn't consume much power, which is a light bulb.
True.
You're staring into a light bulb.
True.
But on plasma, anything that eclipses the light output would have to be compensated for with more power consumption or heat. Mm-hmm. So they tended to not try to put things in front that opaque them out. Unfortunately, the ramification is that if you put it in a window, you've got a great mirror.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, that's the point. That's the thing I'm trying to get at is one of the drawbacks of plasma. I mean, each technology, and we get back to this now, has its strengths and its weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And yet LCD seems to be clearly dominating the flat panel market. I mean, last I heard, plasma was, I don't know, well under 20% of the market, maybe 10 to 15% or something. Yep. Do you see a long-term future for plasma, or is it on its way out? I hope not.
Beta VHS. You know?
Touche. Okay.
Those who choose not to remember history are condemned to repeat it.
Condemned to repeat it. You really think that plasma versus LCD is a beta versus VHS kind of situation?
I think it didn't have to be, but I think it will be remembered as that.
Mm. A much longer tail of that kind of situation because beta actually never did die out. I mean, it was used professionally all along.
Still is. I mean,
in a digital form.
HD cam is a direct grandchild of Betamax.
That's right. That's right.
I think plasma will stay around. I don't think it will be a mass market television because of economies of scale.
Mm.
The market for flat phosphor based imaging.
Mm-hmm.
For things like the post-production world, for photography applications, for aspects of medical imaging, for times where you need very fast refreshes, the military's stuff. I mean, there's lots of uses for it as non-TV that it excels at. It's very good at.
Yeah.
But I think it's just the juggernaut of producing an enormous amount of cheap things. They get better. And at some point, we all threw away our betas.
True enough. I mean, it used to be that LCDs were, in fact, more expensive than plasmas at a given screen size.
Yep.
And now that's not true, except at very large sizes. Very large sizes, I think LCDs are still more expensive, aren't they?
Yes, but again, that's a volume issue and the shipping issue. But plasma was cheaper to produce at a bill of materials cost, at a factory cost.
Mm-hmm.
But that's changing now that there's just so much LCD. I think we'll probably see companies like Panasonic continue and LG continue to produce plasma.
Mm-hmm. Samsung as well.
Probably more money. It's a continuing to improve and develop unless they can see some market. And, historically, not enough people. Well, I guess it's a history of pioneers displays. Not enough people were willing to pay for a better picture to justify the market.
Right, right. And there's also the issue that has been relayed to me a number of times that LCDs, because they can actually produce more raw light output, look better on the showroom floor.
Oh, completely.
They attract more attention on the showroom floor, and people go, oh, I want that one. That one over there is really dim, and they're looking at the plasma.
Yeah. It is surprising how many people in this industry have never done lights on, lights off tests.
Mm.
Just turn the lights on, turn the lights off with two different types of displays, an LCD and a plasma. And you watch that total change of the picture quality. One looks good with the lights on, one looks good with the lights off. You don't shop with the lights off. So
the answer is to buy one of each, of course.
Well, yeah, I think so. yeah, exactly. And I think we should all have Ferraris. And we should all put trailer hitches on our porch. Yeah.
I like it. Now, LCDs, of course, have one of the reasons I prefer plasma, of course, I watch it in a black hole, such as this. Is all the things some of the things we've talked about already, fast motion detail, deeper blacks, typically better contrast ratio overall. And LCD has done a lot to overcome these problems with local dimming, which, as you say, is not perfect, with 120 hertz or 240 hertz processing, which also isn't perfect. It does sharpen up the motion detail, but it also makes the picture takes on a video cast, yes. A video look.
So hold on one second. Now, this is one that makes me nuts.
Okay, go.
So we started to go to 120 hertz on LCD. We were doing black frame insertion. They were pulsing backlights. They were using the fact that it's not as much of the speed of the LCD's changing of state. It's the fact that it changes the state and doesn't pulse the state. So they discovered
it's a continuous change, you mean?
Right. It's a fluid change, which gives it that mushiness.
As opposed to plasma, which changes states in pulses.
Yes.
What we call subfields.
Yes, exactly. And the subfields, you use pulse width modulation. Remember, plasma is digital, LCD is analog. Most people think that LCD is a digital display. It's not. It's an analog display. And
because of the changing voltage on the LCD crystal itself causes it to become more or less opaque.
Right. In a
smoothly varying manner.
Right, exactly. It's an analog display.
Interesting. Okay.
So when you can get as fast as you want for the structure change within the LCD, okay, but it doesn't perceive as a sharper, crisper picture or less blur. Mm. There's a great write-up in SID, the Society of Information Display, did a great write-up on this. Did a whole bunch of testing on it. Turns out when you do black frame insertion, that's where you get rid of that motion blur.
Mm.
But the initial stuff was great. And then this whole specsmanship number game became part of it. And we now want 240 hertz. And we want, whatever. It was throw high numbers out. Well, if you have to interpolate new frames from your other frames, and you're trying to do it on the cheap, you're not going to maybe use all the pixels. You're going to do some sort of field interpolation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you start to get these mushy video-like looks.
Because
you're screwing it up.
Well, no computer is going to be able to interpolate to create new frames to place in between existing frames perfectly.
I would say that pretty true statement. It's possible to make a computer that does it. A video process that does it very pleasingly and very good, but it's not possible to do that cheaply. So if you look at like the Silicon Optics, it does very good processing, and it's a very expensive scaler.
Yeah.
So when you're trying to make a, $500 42-inch, LCD, you don't really got the money there to buy a $50 chip.
Processing. So you're saying that black frame insertion, which is instead of inserting interpolated frames between the actual frames, you're inserting black frames, essentially.
Yeah.
Does a similar job of cleaning up motion detail without adding a video look. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Absolutely. And I remember a few years ago, we were looking at some of the very first LCDs that had 120 hertz. And I was thinking, this is crazy because they're calling it the same thing, but some people are using frame interpolation, some people are using frame doubling, some people are using black frame insertion, some people are pulsing the backlight like a shutter in a movie theater is shuttering the light.
Some people are doing that a combination of those things. For example, some 240 hertz, what are called 240 hertz LCDs, are actually 120 hertz with interpolation plus backlight flashing.
Right. So
and you never know.
You never know. That's why when anyone brings up 120 or 240, I'm just going, okay, you've just brought up an issue that without defining what it really is, which part of it, which process is this one better? I tend to turn it off.
Well, so does Tom Norton, my colleague at UAV and Home Theater, because he really hates that video look. I myself... Yeah. I don't particularly mind it. I'd rather see the sharper motion detail.
Okay.
But that's an issue of, to each their own, right?
Yeah. In the plasma world, a pioneer, we had Advanced Pure Cinema. And it was doing, it would show each film frame three times. So it would go up at a 72 hertz refresh.
Right. When it got a 24 hertz input signal from Blu-ray.
Yep. And when we came up with smooth motion, or what do we call it? Smooth?
Smooth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they took a holistic approach on how this whole signal was going to work. So rather than take a video input and then go through a switching mechanism of some sort and then a deinterlacing, then a scaling, then have to convert it to the subfield arrangements that are necessary to drive a plasma, we had that all done within one chip. And thus we could make decisions for visual benefits, like halfway through this drive sequence, we're going to change something. Because we didn't have to come to common points between each of the chips, which you would have to do if you bought things from suppliers.
Right.
It was little things like that the Pioneer spent a lot of energy on that really made good pictures.
And expensive TVs.
But the end result is that, you know, the 60 hertz smooth looked really damn good.
Now, I agree with you. I do agree with you. Let's make sure that everybody understands this one thing about how plasmas work, since this is Home Theater Geeks, after all. Let's get a little geeky. And we alluded a moment ago to subfields and pulsing.
Yep.
Can you go into a little bit of detail about that?
Yep. Okay. So if anyone understands how digital audio works, a pulse width modulated. We start a different way. Okay, so you got a light switch in the wall controlling a light bulb in a room.
Right.
If you turn it on, it's bright in the room. You turn it off, it's dark in the room. If you turn it on and off, then you'll get a headache because it's flickering.
Right.
If you turn it on and off faster than your eye can see the flicker.
Right.
Then the amount of light in the room will be somewhere between off and on because you're turning it off and on.
Right. And this depends, of course, on how long of the on-off cycle it's on and how long of the on-off cycle it's off.
Right. The relationship between how much of it is in the on time and how much is in the off time.
Technically known as duty cycle.
Right. The duty cycle of the on to the off, the relationship.
So if you have a 50%, which would be half time on, half time off.
Exactly.
60%, as in 60% of the time it's on, 40% of the time it's off, which would be a little brighter, and so on.
Yep. So in a plasma, depending on the manufacturer and their technologies, you're dealing with somewhere between, say, 500 and 900 times per second. 500 and 900... Yeah, times per second, that it's going to be showing an on or an off. And that on and that off are going to be of different amounts of time.
Mm-hmm.
So let's call it 500 subfields is what they're called, parts of a field. And those subfields are going to either have a different amount of time duration, in which case it'd be like a pulse width modulated, different amounts of time for each of the pulses.
Mm-hmm.
Or be consistent amounts of time, and you would just be showing or not showing some of them. But it's a whole idea of you're going to show light and then not show light, and you're going to manage it with a system they call subfields.
Subfields.
And a subfield is part of a field. A field is part of a frame. A frame is,
The frame is one image that you see 24 or 48 or 72 or 60 or however many times per second.
Exactly.
But aren't each of these subfields an entire frame?
Nope.
The entire image being flashed onto the screen for some fraction of a frame's duration?
If you have a 100% white picture, then each of the subframes would light up all of the pixels.
Subfields, you mean?
Yes. Subfields, yeah. So each of the subfields would be at 100% always firing. If you were to look at a picture of a normal grayscale, an image, with a very fast camera and take a picture of it, it would look like a checkerboard because some pixels would be firing and some wouldn't.
Ah, some pixels are... So pixels are firing alternately in a more or less checkerboard pattern.
Yep. Really, really fast.
Okay. So that's not like fields in the classic sense of alternating lines on the screen, alternating horizontal Correct. Lines, I should say, but rather Right. in a sort of a checkerboard pattern.
Yep. I think of it as, you know, remember the anatomy books that would have all the vellum, the clear plastic, and you layer all the bits together?
Yes, yes. Uh-huh.
Yes, it's sort of the skeleton, and you put the muscles and all that, and you look at the top of it, and it's a naked person. You pull off the first level, you get the full structure. Well, that's kind of how I look at each of those pages would be a subfield.
Ah, very good, very good. I was told once by a Panasonic guy that the duration of the subfields, at least in their case, started out relatively long and got progressively shorter. Is that typical? Or
totally dependent on the manufacturer and whose intellectual property.
Yeah,
there's an interesting thing called false contour,
yes.
which looks very similar to quantization. But false contour goes away when you put the picture in pause. So if you're seeing what looks like quantization and you pause it and the quantization goes away, mm-hmm. you were looking at false contour.
Interesting.
What false contour is when you have a situation where those subfields are of differing amounts of time, and one pixel is at 49%, and one pixel is at 50%,
mm-hmm.
and the first, let's call them, seven subfields fire for the 49% pixel, and the pixel next to it, the 50% field fires, but collectively your eye sees those together and makes a virtual pixel in the center of it at 100%, or at 99%. It's an optical illusion that has to do with adjacent pixels when their grayscale values are very close, and
but not identical,
right? And you're using subfields that have non-consistent timing.
Interesting.
And that was one of the things at Pioneer we totally excelled. We got rid of that whole problem
because you made the subpixel times the same, consistent. Yep. I should say.
Yep, we called it continuous emission display. And it was the process of using a lot more subfields of the same amount of time and managing them from time moving forward as opposed to sort of haphazardly moving them around where they could get into adjacent combinations that looked bad.
Huh. I didn't know that. I did know that Panasonic makes... Sorry?
That was pretty geeky.
But hey, we're home theater geeks, aren't we?
Yeah.
You are. I am.
Well,
our listeners are.
Yes.
It reminds me that Panasonic is now doing a specsmanship kind of thing, which is a little disappointing, but I guess they have to. You know, calling their plasmas 600 hertz subfield drive in an attempt to compete with LCDs at 120 or 240 hertz.
Yeah.
But they're really comparing apples and oranges. They're not the same thing at all.
They're totally not the same, and they have no value of any useful information. They haven't made anyone smarter, better able to choose the technology. Right.
Yeah, okay. So, fine. Enough of that. Well, listen, I think we've come to the end of our time together. I want to thank you very much for joining me on the show.
I've also thought that this has been fun.
I'm glad you think so.
About the video. Cool. All right.
Okay. You can find Josh online at dispeng.com. That's DISPENG.com for display engineering. Just in case you care to go there. My online homes are ultimateavmag.com and hometheatermag.com. And you can email me with questions or suggestions for future podcast guests at scott@twit.tv. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Floyd Toole, a master acoustician recently retired from Harman International, who wrote a great book on the acoustics and psychoacoustics of speakers in rooms. So I'm really looking forward to talking with him. And until then, geek out.